Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Some modern love stories are timeless, but others belong very much to a particular moment. This week's story, by Aaron Long, is about a biological family that could only exist today. Aaron's essay is read by Cal Penn. He's best known for his work in Harold and Kumar and House, and he's starring now in NBC's Sunnyside, which premieres this Thursday.
I didn't meet my girlfriend Jessica until 12 years after our daughter Alice was born. Let me explain. Nearly 25 years ago, I returned from a year of teaching English abroad, moved in with my mother, and, lacking prospects, began driving a cab. One day I saw a newspaper ad seeking healthy men, 18 to 35, to participate in a semen donation program. Donors is the standard industry word, yet virtually all of us are paid. $40 a pop is what I received in 1994. I applied to sell my sperm and sold twice weekly for a year. At the time, I was in a long-distance relationship, so this seemed like a good outlet. When I told my mother, she presciently wondered aloud if this was the only way she was going to have grandchildren. Today, sperm buyers view detailed profiles for potential vendors, whereas I wasn't asked to provide much beyond college major, hobbies, and family health history. Jessica and her partner at the time chose me primarily because I was a writer and musician. After a year of selling my sperm, I went back to giving it away and largely forgot about the whole thing. Occasionally, the subject of whether I had children would come up and I'd make a joke about probably having a bunch. I had signed a non-disclosure waiver and assumed there would never be a way for my progeny and me to find one another. Then the internet happened. In the early 2000s, I searched online for a way to find my offspring and discovered the Donor Sibling Registry. I didn't see any leads there and never got around to checking back. I had looked way too early. My progeny began to use the site to find each other when they became teenagers in the 2010s. A couple of years ago, I began seeing ads for 23andMe, a service that analyzes your saliva. You spit in a test tube and mail it off for analysis, and provides you with information about ancestry, health, and DNA relatives. The opportunity was obvious, but I assumed the odds of finding my children were low. I procrastinated for months before curiosity and an urge to know them made me order a kit. I got my results back, and boom! I had a son, Bryce. His full name was unusual enough that I easily Googled him, and the picture resembled me enough that I felt confident this senior geography major was mine. Mine? Guessing he had been notified of my existence by 23andMe, I mulled for a week before finally putting fingers to keyboard. "Dear Bryce," I wrote, "I recently joined 23andMe and found you listed as my son, so I believe myself to be your biological father. I hope my existence isn't a shock and wonder whether you joined in the hopes of connecting with me." My letter continued awkwardly from there, giving him a brief sketch of my life. Bryce replied almost instantly. "Dad, I cannot express how excited I am to be hearing from you. I did join 23andMe hoping that you would have already done so and was upset to see you hadn't. This is amazing, though, and I'm so happy. I'm one of six of your children that I'm aware of and in contact with. I'm 20 years old and live on Long Island, but I'm studying in upstate New York." Dad? I was briefly concerned that Bryce might have some fatherly expectations of me and show up on my doorstep, but my worries were unfounded. It's a brave new world, and we're all struggling with the terminology. More important, six children? Yikes! I did some napkin math based on the number of samples I provided and the odds of conception and estimated that I may have as many as 67 children. Bryce connected me with Madeline, 19. Upon viewing her Facebook page, I had my first parental thought ever. My daughter should put some more clothes on. I may be biased, but I found my children to be ridiculously attractive. I felt a sudden need to share their photos with all the ex-girlfriends who chose not to marry and procreate with me. A few months later, a new DNA relative appeared on 23andMe. Alice, age 11. Her mother, Jessica, wrote me a note. She and her former partner had each given birth to one daughter conceived with my sperm. They broke up years ago but had been raising both girls together until recently when the other mother moved away with the daughter she'd given birth to. Jess and I began to chat online. She knew a lot about buying sperm and self-impregnating, which was fascinating for me to learn. As it turns out, it was more difficult than my role, masturbating into a cup. She also no longer identified as lesbian and was dating a man who, incredibly, had my same first and middle names, Aaron David, with a similar monosyllabic last name. Had there been a mix-up at the Bureau of Boyfriends? Was I the one who was supposed to be dating her? My children and I exchanged written biographies. Bryce's showed me how little I know of young adult culture and reminded me that one's 20s are a difficult decade. Maddie's revealed a keen understanding of her upbringing and the parts of it she would like to break from. But it was Alice's, entitled A Series of Awkward Events Separated by Snacks, that floored me. Her biography was a hodgepodge of lists and memories written under duress. Mom, right or death? Favorite color? Black, like my soul. Favorite holiday? Halloween, because candy and murder. She liked Alfred Hitchcock films. Basically, she wrote, I'm an angsty teen in a child's body. This kid's 11? A plan developed for Bryce and Maddie to come to Seattle for a couple of weeks in the summer. Jess and Alice lived a few hours south and would drive up. I figured meeting my children was going to be the closest thing I'd ever have to a wedding, so I decided to host a party. I had told my news to a few people, but most learned of it from the Meet My Kids Party Facebook invitation featuring photos of Bryce, Maddie, and Alice. The shock value was high. Be it genetics, good luck, or force of circumstance, I loved my children right away. They have an uncanny aura of meanness. Bryce is shy but sharp and obsessed with memes in a way I might have been had I grown up Gen Z. Alice has little use for adults, as I still don't. Maddie, especially, has my sense of humor and eyes. Locking gazes with her makes my brain explode, but then we laugh. At the party, we played a nature versus nurture question and answer game and discovered we were all quite liberal and that none of us believed in God. None of them, however, sleeps with a pillow between their knees, as I have long done. The first time Jess and I found ourselves alone, we hugged at length in a way entirely inappropriate for people who had just met. Jess says I have mannerisms that remind her of both her daughters and thus felt instantly comfortable with me. Whether we were pawns of fate or unwitting participants in a chromosomally arranged marriage, Jess and I quickly bonded. I deployed my Bureau of Boyfriends mix-up line to a grudging but sweet reception. During the vacation, she and I easily fell into the mom and dad role for Bryce, Maddie, and Alice. We soon had in-jokes and teased each other about our foibles, just like any family. I even gave Bryce and Maddie a lecture about smoking. At the end of the visit, Bryce somehow managed to get Jess and Alice kicked out of the house they were renting by climbing onto the roof to retrieve a toy, so I invited them to stay with me while they figured things out. What Jess soon figured out was that she wanted to keep staying with me. Alice rolled her eyes as if she'd been tricked into a traditional family arrangement. While 23andMe is not generally considered a dating site, Jess and I are grateful to the technology that has made our backward-formed relationship possible. We have a lot of questions about love and genetics and whether we would have felt this connection had we met in a more conventional way. Our bond has survived the how cool is this phase, though we still enjoy cyber-monitoring my other progeny and speculating about how many more may emerge. I'm up to 10 now. I've had some contact with the new one's mothers, but haven't made plans to meet yet. Maddie liked the West Coast and us and recently moved into our place. We're hoping to lure Bryce back, too. In the end, the sci-fi trappings of our love story are irrelevant. Jess and I work as a couple because we like spending time together. Suppose it doesn't hurt that I happen to be the father of her child.
That's Cal Penn reading Aaron Long's essay, First I Met My Children, Then My Girlfriend, They're Related. We'll catch up with Aaron and with Jessica after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Aaron Long's essay was published in September 2018. He and Alice's mother, Jessica, are still together and live in the same communal home in Seattle. They both joined us for this conversation, and they told us more about what it was like to start dating when they already had children together.
It just immediately felt like we were on the same team and kind of had the same goal of making this interesting introduction to each other and to my other children, who also were there right at the beginning, just like a positive experience for all of us. We kind of had a project to work on together, and that was a good bonding experience.
But Jessica had a different experience.
I trusted him a lot less than I would have anyone else that I was just dating, because I knew going in that this was bad mommy 101. You don't get involved with someone who has to be there for your kids the rest of their lives. Aaron, to this day, he hasn't had a partner. He hasn't had kids. He's like, yeah, you want to go for coffee? I really had to get to a place where I trusted him a lot before I said yes to coffee even. And I feel like even though our relationship is more serious now, it's much lighter.
Aaron, Jessica, and Alice are planning to move into a new home together soon. And Aaron says that he hasn't found out about any biological children beyond the 10 he knew about when he wrote this essay.
My relationship with each of the kids that I've met is pretty different. I sort of live with Alice and will probably, you know, within the next year really live with her. But I do not expect to be her parent in any kind of traditional way. I will be there as a supportive figure for Jess, and I will play whatever role in Alice's life that develops between us. You know, she currently views me not as family, but as her mom's boyfriend, who she thinks is okay, and that is totally fine with me. Bryce, we have a limited relationship. We sometimes text each other updates in our lives, but just due to his distance away, we haven't developed that much of a relationship. Maddie really liked Jess and I and wound up moving to Seattle. She calls me her dad. I mean, she doesn't call me that to my face. She doesn't say, hey, dad. But if she introduces me to someone, she introduces me as her dad. So that's maybe the closest to a parental relationship that we have going. But we're really just friends who happen to have this DNA connection.
At this point, Aaron has met 4 of the 10 biological children he's aware of. But one child he hasn't met is the daughter that Jessica's ex-wife gave birth to. That daughter was also conceived with Aaron's sperm, but Jessica says that her ex-wife has left and cut off contact. As for the children Aaron has met, they have a lot in common.
My sense when I'm with any of them is they just kind of feel like me. They feel like they're a little bit quiet, a little bit shy, but they're paying attention. They're pretty observant. That's the main kind of similarity that I see between all of us.
There are like three distinct types that all the kids can fall into. They're introverted, but they're not shy. They're incredibly confident. They're incredibly articulate. And if you put them on the spot and you force them to answer, you're like, wow, you knew what was going on all along. You're not introverted at all. You totally got this. But they're not going to offer it.
And Jessica and Aaron are both open to this new, unconventional family.
I absolutely view Aaron as family and Aaron's other kids as family. These are the siblings of my children. And, you know, I think I said right off the bat, I've never met these kids before, but if they dropped out of school and rolled up over to my front door, like, come on in. I will make you dinner. I will make you dinner forever.
That's Jessica Scher and Aaron Long. They live in Seattle. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Well, advances in technology are changing relationships in all kinds of ways. To the surprise of people who donated sperm and thought that that would always be something that was, you know, private, and then suddenly all these services come out where your DNA links you to people and you can get in touch with children. And it's a brave new world with what we can find out about who we're related to. But few stories that I've seen have had as many twists and complications and opportunities and sort of joy as this one.
And here's Cal Penn.
I recently went on that PBS show, Finding Your Roots, and found nothing extraordinary. So this story is the exact opposite, where there's a bit of, you know, you spit in a vial genealogy and uncovered a lot. I mean, obviously, he knew that he had donated his sperm for a year, so he was hoping to find something specific. But I think that was one of the reasons I gravitated towards it. And then the other is that it's this beautiful definition of family that I think is wonderful and loving and, you know, is a particularly unique story.
Thanks to Cal for reading this week's essay. You can see him in Sunnyside on NBC. It premieres this Thursday. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. If you love the podcast, rate us or review us on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend to subscribe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.